We're ready to kick off our seminar. Our speaker today is Don Bussey. Don is a hydrogeologist with EPA's Environmental Response Team. He has over 33 years of professional experience. 16 of those have been with EPA's ERT. Prior to joining EPA, he worked for consulting engineering firms as an EPA ERT contractor. He teaches borehole geophysics at EPA-sponsored short courses and at EPA regions, and also at EPA national conferences. He's a Syracuse University grad, and he's a certified professional geologist through AIPG. And Don is coming to us from ERT in Las Vegas, Nevada. Before I turn it over to Don, I just want to remind everyone on the phone one more time to please keep yourself on mute. Don't use that hold button at all, but if you do somehow end up getting unmuted, please hit *6 to put yourself on mute. And I'll give you some info at the end of this session, but we do have two more seminars related to this topic. And so I invite you to stay tuned for just a moment after we finish up. And with that, Don, if you're all set, I will hand it over to you.
Okay, Cindy, thank you. I can't seem to minimize that little bar in the lower right.
Okay, Don. It's Jean. Feel free to go ahead and click through your slides, and we'll watch. Sometimes it takes a second for the controls to come back, but we'll see if we can minimize here in just a moment.
Okay. Anyway, thank you all for attending the webinar this morning or afternoon, wherever you may be. My name is Don Bussey. I'm with EPA's Environmental Response Team. I see by the polling that has been conducted that about two-thirds of you have some background, and kind of that's what I would have expected, because why would you, I mean, I would assume that you'd be have an interest in this type of a technology. And about a third of you are beginners and are probably anxious to learn. Additionally, there's a couple of you that are long-time users of the technology, and hopefully you'll learn something and that and the case studies will be interesting for you. So anyway, I'll begin. The geophysical tools that I think are most appropriate for the kind of work we do as groundwater geologists are listed on the screen right here. And they're not by any means all of the techniques that are out there. There are some cross-hole techniques that are kind of complex and above the scope of this webinar. And there are lots of tools associated with the oil and gas industry that we're just not going to go into. But the tools that are listed here are basically what I use when I do groundwater studies. And all of them except for the natural gamma really need to be run in open hole boreholes, open rock boreholes. Natural gamma can be run in cased holes. So we're going to step through each one of these. And as you can see here, some pictures, the tools hang into the well. They're running over the tripod here, and they come back to a winch that has the cable that connects the tool to the computer. And you've got mechanics here that drive the winch up or down, and you have a power source. This equipment can be shipped, and it's easy to do. You can see over here on the right the tools are and the equipment are packed up and ready to be shipped. And these are some examples of what the sounds look like. They're meant to go downhole, obviously. There are also vehicles that are equipped and are ready to go and take to the field with you. This upper one on the left is an oil well logging setup. And the other three photographs show you a USGS vehicle that I've worked with. And everything is self-contained and drivable to your site. The natural gabble logging is what I'm going to discuss here first. It's pretty much a basic tool. Most everyone's familiar with it. It's useful for evaluating stratigraphic sequences in sedimentary rock, basically. There's some other applications you can use it for, but basically it's a stratigraphic tool, and you'll be able to correlate stratigraphically from borehole to borehole. And again, it can be used in open holes or cased holes. This slide shows you typical responses for the gamma tool and what type of lithology you might be expecting. So you can see a volcanic ash is the has the highest gamma output. That would be like a bentonite, which would be a really good geologic marker because it's considered geologically instantaneous. And you see the shales have pretty high counts. Sands and limestones are really low counts. So that's how you would read this log. And it shows you typical responses. Now, what another use for gamma ray logging is sometimes you can discern faulting in a bedrock sequence. Here we see a fault that's been interpreted, and you see that the unit has been offset. Now, if you drill a hole here, you see the normal stratigraphic sequence. If you drill the hole here, the same. But if you drill the hole here, you'd see a repeat section. And I'll show you an example of what that would look like. Here you have your normal response on a type section. And up here you see that the double repeats of this. That would be telling you that you have a fault in this right in this area, or depth, crossing the borehole. Another tool that I find useful, and it's pretty basic, is a mechanical caliper. It essentially measures the diameter of the borehole wall, of the borehole. This is the what it looks like when the arms are not extended. You would lower the sound into the hole with the arms retracted. Once you reach the bottom of the hole or wherever you want to start your logging, you would send a signal to the tool, which would open the arms. And as the tool is raised in the borehole, whenever fractures or openings are encountered, the tool would open up and then close back up when you got past it. It's a very good tool for looking at fractures that are horizontal or low angle. When you get into high angle fractures, it's a little bit more tough. And I'll show you some ways to deal with that. Here is an example log of a mechanical caliper. And as you can see, we get little kicks here. Typically, this hole is about 6 inches in diameter. And as you can see, you've got some big openings here, here, down here. So that's what a typical log would look like. And I have to apologize for my voice. There's some pollen in the air out here. another log that I find useful is a temperature log. It can be of value in trying to determine if there's any inflow or outflow of water into the borehole from a fracture. And temperature curve is here. You can see it's only a degree from 49.5 to 50.5. Your first kick here is where you encounter the water table. And as it is lowered, you can see a slight increase. But in here, it pops up and there's a change. I can't really know what I'm looking at here because I still have the gray box up on my screen. But you should see a kick in here. Maybe you are seeing it. But that would show you that there's a change in the temperature gradient in the well and that something is going on there. And we'll look at this slide again, upcoming slide. Borehole video logging. And it can give you a lot of value, useful in identifying like solution voids, fractures, borehole blockage, and other downhole shooting. I'll give you some examples of what these video loggings look like. This is a different tool. This one is illuminated. So you would have a light source and you'd be able to see in the dark depths of the borehole. These are some still photographs that were taken. We had some blockage in this boring. And in this one, we were able to go down and see what it was. In addition, here we have some cascading water coming into the borehole. You can take a look at it. And this is actually some type of drill casing that we wanted to go down and see what it looked like. This photograph here shows a well screen in a case well. And you can see you have a little sand at the base of the well, but essentially the well screen is clean, which is something else you can look at if you want to see what your well screen is like. Okay. My mouse froze up for a minute there. Sorry about that. I want to show you some examples of the video itself. In this case, it's a cascading water. Yeah, I think you might find it interesting, except for it's not launching. There it is. Okay, here we go. Take a second to start. There we go. So if you ever wonder what a borehole looked like, you get the picture here. This was a hammer drilled hole, so you can see it's pretty rough on the walls. The next slide is a cored hole, and it also has some cascading water, which is kind of fun to look at. But it really helps you to determine what's going on in your borehole and set up your sampling strategy. And I think I have one more. This hole is at 178 feet. In a particular case, this was a cored hole that we were able to take a look at some solution fracturing. Not fracturing, but dissolution. And you can see the void that we're coming into right here. It was an interesting hole. Once we got there, we really couldn't go any further the way we were drilling because we were losing all our circulation. But I'll play it one more time. Very good. There you go. Another example of a downhole camera. This one is looking at the borehole wall itself, and as you can see, there's the camera. It can be illuminated, or it would be illuminated. This particular tool has a compass associated with it that keeps the bearing constant. In other words, you know where north is. As the tool is lowered, they usually twist. But you're always knowing where your compass bearing is. I've actually seen Dean Apple weeping out of fractures with a camera like this. And this is that camera, but it's illuminated just to give you an example of what it looks like. Here's another one, another example. They're kind of similar in their construction. And this is a picture typical of what you would see with one of those cameras, where you can see the sand pack in the screen. Pretty neat to see. If you ever have to troubleshoot, you're wondering if your screens are fouled, this can be a benefit for you. Okay. The acoustic and optical televiewing logging is a very valuable tool. Again, it is also compass oriented so that no matter how the tool twists down the hole, you get a you know where north is, and that can be valuable. Now I'll show you why. Televiewer logging presents a 360 degree acoustical or optical image of the borehole. You can look at even high angle fractures that the caliper tool may be missed, and bedding, and also solution voids or voids. And you can also determine striking depth of your fractures, and I'll show you how that's done. Here is one of the, I think this is the acoustic tool, but the optical, or the optical tool, but the acoustic tool works the same way. It essentially, you lower the tool into the borehole, and here is where the action happens. If you can take a look, you should see some flickering. I'll play it one more time. What happens is you're lowering this tool down the borehole, and as you're going, it's spinning. And in the case of the optical televiewer, it's taking little micro pictures that are all pieced together as you go down the hole. The acoustic televiewer, it was actually sends out an acoustic ping into the borehole and back, into the borehole wall and back. And the logging that you get looks like these two logs here. Now, the acoustic televiewer, the ATV, only works from below the water table because you have to have the hole has to have water in order for the sound wave to propagate. So this here is noise, and then the logging starts here. This is the optical televiewer, and it's like I said, it's the pictures, little micro pictures. And as it goes down, and as you can see, it's oriented 0 degrees north, 90, south, 180, 270, back to zero. Same thing for the optical. So what happens is if you look at this borehole and you slice it down, like it's a tube of paper, from a paper towel tube, you slice it at north and open it up. And that's what gives you, that's the image you get. Now, I usually like to run both of them because you can't see above the water in a acoustic tool, but you can in the optical. But as you can see in the optical, it's clearer here than it is below the water, a little bit more cloudy. The reasoning is that you have some suspended particles that are muddying up the image somewhat. So I like to run both. Now, let me show you about the fracturing. Now, again, picture that tube that's opened up. And you can see this point here matches with that point there. So that's how it opened. And it sliced across the borehole with the lower part of the fracture being almost south and the upper part of the fracture being to the north. So it's cutting north to south through the borehole. You know the diameter of the borehole based on your caliper curve, in this case about 6 inches. You know the distance between here and there because you got a scale, it's over a couple feet, and you know the compass orientation. So when you factor in all those conditions, you can get the strike and dip of these fractures that are coming through. You see it, you see more of them here. Same, you see how they kind of mimic each other from the, I want to go back. They're kind of showing the same thing. So, and so now if you take your cut open tube and turn it back on itself, you can actually create a virtual core. And this is an example of a virtual core. You could do it with the optical or the acoustic televiewer. And see, you know where north is. They're spatially referenced. Okay, this tool is very useful. I find a lot of use for it. It's the heat pulse flow meter. Now, this is the tool itself. These are centralizers. Actually, water diversion, in this case down here. This is a centralizer. So, and that's a close-up of this portion here. And this is your schematic. This particular tool had a natural gamma included. So what happens is you have a heating grid and a thermometer, essentially. Heating grid here, the thermometer is here and here. So This tool is not a continuous log. It's a stationary log. You go to one spot and you get a data point. So you lower it to your point that you've chosen based on your other logging or coring or geologic notes from your geologist. And you would push a button, essentially fire up the grid. And then as over time, if there's any movement in the well vertically, upwards or downwards, you will see a response in the appropriate at the appropriate thermometer. And there's a you can take the output from that and discern not only which way the water may be flowing in the hole at that location, but also how quickly it might be flowing, the velocity. And I'll give you an example of that here. So you've got your gamma, you've got your mechanical caliper, you've got your two televiewers, your temperature log. And this is the heat pulse flow meter log, HPFM. And this is in gallons per minute, minus 0.3 gallons, positive 0.3. Minus meaning going down, positive meaning upflow. So in this case, the water level began here. That's where the static level was in the water, of the water in the well. And I picked, in this case, these locations vertically to do the heat pulse flow meter. And it was basically based upon what I was seeing in the caliper log and what I saw down here with the caliper log and the other optical logging. So I chose these positions. Now here we got a downward flow, a little less downward flow, so we must have had something going out, a little bit going out here, downward, and then here, no flow. And you can see there's voids here. So there's no flow in the well below the voids. This was a well that had cascading water. The water would come in. This is the static level that equilibrated. But there was downward flow, and it exited here. Here's another example. In this case, we have upward flow. And at this point, there's no flow. So water's coming up the hole from the bottom of the hole and then exiting probably in this fracture here, one of these areas. There we go. Now in this case, this hole had no flow. Then it had, but here it had downward flow, and here there was upward flow. So you've got flow in both directions, both exiting in these fractures right here. I hope everyone can see and understand that. So why is borehole deviation logging? Sometimes you want to know if your hole is straight, and especially if you're doing packer testing and you want to make sure that you can get your tool down the well, you might want to consider a borehole deviation log. This is some examples of some of the output. Now, in this particular case, if this hole was perpendicular to the earth, straight down, you just see a red dot right there where I'm pointing to. But you see with depth, it's running off towards the west. In this particular case, the reason why it was diverting was because it was in a metamorphic terrain and it hit the bedrock and it's ran off with the foliation of the metamorphic rock. Same hole, but in a different perspective. This is looking at it from as a cross section. This hole was in the front yard of a residence, and we logged it. We were able to use her residential well. Her house was here. The road was here. Her neighbor's house was here. Her neighbor's backyard is here. So as you can see, the hole started in the front yard of this lady's house and ended up in the backyard across the street. So holes aren't normally straight or perpendicular to the plane of the earth. This is another depiction of a hole that's corkscrewing. And again, you can see you're not dealing with straight holes. It's very uncommon to see a totally straight hole. Now I got my favorite one coming next. What do you think of that one? Hole almost immediately was going towards the northeast, bent, and went almost westward. The explanation here is the first 140 feet was a glacial till, and the drill bit hit a boulder near the surface and ran off this way. And the till was over a metamorphic rock, and then it hit the metamorphic rock and ran to the west. It was very difficult getting a packer assembly down that well. But you can see the value in knowing what you're dealing with so that you just don't get out to the job site with your packer testing equipment and not be able to get down the hole and wonder why. Okay. What is borehole? What I think the most value of borehole geophysical data as far as its usability is foremost packer test design. Also, for designing discrete zone multi-level assemblies, and we'll talk about that here. And it also can affect your groundwater packer testing sampling strategy. And I've got a couple of case studies that will go into that. So, for those that don't know, this is how a packer assembly is assembled. And it goes down into the boring. It's a cartoon. What it is that you have inflatable packers here and here. And you have a screen, a slotted screen with a pump inside. It's inflated by gas lines that go to the surface. It also has to have a pump, so you have wiring. And it will sample this zone. And why would you identify that zone? You would identify it based on your analysis of your borehole geophysics, looking at where you think fracturing is, looking at are these fractures producing water or are they accepting water? And in the case studies, that'll become very clear how you would design a sampling strategy based on geophysical data. And your discrete zone multi-level assemblies, are things like the West Bay system, flute liners, Solanus, there's others. But essentially what you're doing is fitting a well so that you can come back to it later and always sample the same zones that you've identified by your geophysics. This particular slide is showing an assembly of a West Bay system. Based on the geophysics, and probably also the packer testing before it, your zones were identified, and then were machined and cut to length of the section that you're isolating. And you just lower these down to the hole. They're numbered 1, 2, 3, 4. You put them in order. And you know where in your geophysics discern where those packers were going to be placed. These blue things are the packers in the assembly that are inflated permanently via hydraulics once they're into the borehole. And this is just an example of how they're screwed together and added piece by piece until you get your whole system in the hole. And that's one of the packers. Right here. So again, it could be any number of assemblies. There's different ones, or you can do what this consulting firm did for the responsible party here on this site and decided just to set normal wells at 6 intervals. With these packers, you can set multiple, however many you want, intervals in the same well. And you just run a tool down the center. It's like an elevator. It would lock into a port. And then you would manual, or you would send a signal down the hole to open the port. You're not only able to get a water sample, but a head reading at that isolated zone. So you can do it that way, or you can do it this way. I'm not sure which is more expensive, but my guess is this is. And then I want to now give you a couple of case studies how this geophysical data was really instrumental in some investigations. This site was in a mountainous area of Puerto Rico, and they had a municipal well that was contaminated. It was drilled right by a steep inclined mountain stream. And why would they put it there? Because it's close to the water level, so you don't have a lot of depth to have to drill. And also, you're probably going to encounter more fractures there. So again, this is a steeply incised stream. The stream showed contamination, and the well was contaminated with volatiles. And we ran this log, and you can see we did both the acoustic and the optical televiewer, and a mechanical packer. Mechanical caliper. And you can see that there's fractures here, high up in the hole. Here's your surface casing set to about, 18 feet. But as you can see, they didn't set it deep enough to get the case off all of those fractures. So that was how the contaminated stream water was getting into the borehole. These people were drinking stream water, and they didn't know it. Which had other implications such as coliform, et cetera. So if you look further down the hole, there's another big void here at the base. So the questions I had to look at was, if we were able to cut this water off, would this lower zone produce enough water in and of itself to supply the municipality? And we set a packer somewhere here in this dense rock where there's no fractures at all, no flow. And I sampled above the packer and below. We sampled above the packer. We know we had downward flow because, that's something else to mention. In this case, this is the heat pulse flow meter. You can see it's not a dot, like I showed you before. This particular company used histograms. But you can see no flow. Minus flow, positive flow. So we've got downward flow, downward flow, downward flow, downward flow, until it hits here, and then it goes off into the formation. So the stream was actually running down the borehole and out into this lower zone. So we did the packer testing. First of all, in the lower zone, I determined that, yes, that lower zone could produce enough water that was needed without the contribution from the fracturing up here, where the stream water was getting in. So we set a packer here. We pumped this upper zone, and seeing how we had downward flow, we just pumped typical three volumes of the open hole interval to get a sample. But when I sampled below where we set the packer, down in here, we've been having downward flow from the stream for I don't know how long, but I wanted to see what the real water quality was in that lower zone. Water quality up here in the upper zone was contaminated, as you would expect, because it was taking contaminated stream water in. But this lower zone, I decided, based on the geophysics, knowing that there was downward flow, knowing where the openings in the rock were, that I would sample over time and see if there was any change over time. Here was it's not the actual data, but it supports my point. The concentrations initially were high, but after numbers of volumes were pumped, they tailed off, which was telling me that the lower zone had been impacted and contaminated by the upper zone, but if we could seal it off, we could use this well without having to drill a new one and run all the associated plumbing and pipes. And so really what happened was after time, it fell down below MCLs and we were able to take it off the carbon system. So that was very valuable. It saved us a lot of money and a lot of time, just by understanding the what was going on with the boring based on the geophysics. Now, this next case study was a site in upstate New York, Cayuga County groundwater site. This is an idealized cross-section of the stratigraphy there. You can see there's a glacial overburden. Topography goes from north, I'm sorry, from south, dipping towards the north. So that's the way water would run on the surface. But you can see how the stratigraphy dips to the south, opposite of topography. So what was happening here is that there was a site located about right here that had a significant VOC problem on their facility. And the Department of Health, the State Department of Health, had was sampling production wells 7 miles away. Here's the site, and 7 miles way off this picture. I'll show you another one in a minute. But once they identified that there was contamination in that production well, they started to work back to try to find the source, and they came from the south to the north, and they were sampling these residential wells. And you can see the ones in red are contaminated. The ones in blue aren't. So it had to be a specific elevation or depth of where the contaminate was. So we were tasked with identifying the source for attribution. Let me make sure I haven't forgotten anything on this. Nope. And you've seen this log before. So again, we had the caliper, we had the televiewer logs, we had a temperature kick, we knew we had downward flow going out here. So we designed a packer testing strategy based on that. And we also did our heat pulse flow meter. That's how we knew downward flow. So I wanted to know what was going on here. We did have cascading water, so we had water entering the borehole, not from a stream, but just somewhere higher up in the boring and going out here. So we kind of did the packer testing the same way. We isolated this upper zone and sampled it first, and we didn't have to pump because it was downward flow. It was coming into the well all the time. But then this lower hole, this fracturing here, solution voids. I did the same thing. We set our packers here for this zone, and we pumped again over time. And what the result was, in this case, concentrations were high in that lower zone to begin with, but over time, they decreased. Or they increased, sorry. So, again, what was happening here is clean water was coming in from above, making its way down into the zone where the contamination was, and diluting it to a point that you couldn't see it. If you just put a pump in this well and pumped it, you would have thought it was clean. Yet, when you isolated this lower zone, you find that there's 2 parts per million of TCE. So, without the geophysics, without follow-up packer testing, there'd be no way that you would know how to design your packer testing strategy, and you would have missed, even if you set packers here and just pumped a couple volumes out, you would have just had clean water. So again, packer testing via the borehole geophysics was the key to understanding the site. I want to go off a little diatribe here for a second. Geophysically logging a hole is probably less than 20% of what it costs to drill the hole. I just don't understand why it's not done more often in deep bedrock open holes. And, oh, and then there's another thing. Why would you leave a hole open if there was potential for cross-contamination or cross-pollution? Well, in this particular case, there was hundreds of residential wells that were open doing the same thing. And by leaving this hole open a little while in order to test it and log it, we really didn't do any harm. In this case, we did no harm. We were just diluting the contaminated zone. It's not only worth it monetarily, but it's worth it scientifically to do your logging of deep open boreholes because it can give you a lot of information. So the site was here. My study area was here. These are some open hole bedrock wells. What the PRP found was that they had flow in the overburdened shallow bedrock to the north. And they had sentinel wells on the south of the facility that were deeper, that were clean. And they said, well, our flow's going to the north. That's where the contamination's going. Well, it went to the north, got into a sinkhole terrain, hit that stratigraphy that was dipping to the south, and ran right underneath the deeper holes ahead and out into eventually Cayuga Lake, which is 7 miles away. But we found the deeper zones, the flow was going the opposite way. Like I just, to the north in the shallow system, to the south in the deeper system. This is a little cartoon, but shows the same thing. Excuse me. Okay, and then next hole, that was what was really going on. And we traced this plume 7 miles, and I just have to show you this. It's in the bottom of Cayuga Lake. It's right in a old gypsum mine, and gypsum is what? It's really soluble, and that's why we had the solution voids, because that's opened up, and it made a highway for the contamination to get 7 miles down to Union Springs and actually discharge into the lake. We took some samples here. They were clean, but with all that water, I'm not surprised it was diluted. But that's actually a water upwelling into the lake, right where the contamination was ending, endpointing. So again, the local drain to the north, regional drain. There's a lake over here, Awaska Lake, and over here the lake is Cayuga Lake. There is over 100-foot difference in elevation from this lake to that lake. So the regional flow would be expected to go westward. So the regional flow did go westward. The shallow flow went to the northwest. And they missed the contamination going under their wells. Now, this was summarized in a paper that I helped write that is referenced in the reference section of this webinar. Okay, I'm going to give you a little bit of oil and gas well abandonment applications of borehole geophysics. It's also used. There's two logs besides the gamma log, case and collar logs, which are magnetic, and they identify the collars in the pipe, the production pipe in the wells. Where it screws together. Cement bond logs are acoustic logs, and they identify the presence of cement behind log casing. It's useful during casing perforation. Another application of cement bond logging is to evaluate injection wells, where that you want to make sure you have a good cement seal so that you know that where you're injecting water is where it's staying. And I'll show you some examples of what these logs look like. Okay. All right. In this case, this is the case and collar locator log. It's a magnetic log. And when you see these little ticks here, tick, tick, this is where the drill pipe screwed together, which I'll show you what the importance of that is in a second. This is noise. It's kind of rusty. Kind of noisy. We call it ratty. This is a cement bond log. And in this case, from this point down, there's good cement. That's what this log is telling me. When you see that, it's good cement. And when you see separation in these two lines here, there's good cement. When you don't see separation and you see this noise, there's no cement. So the best way to abandon this log would be to come in, shoot off, get out as much casing as possible, and then grout the hole. So what we did is we know where the casing collars are, where they screw together. And those are the best spots to use a small explosive to blast the casing out of the hole. Not blast it, but separate it. And then it can be pulled out of the hole. Then you could go in with your grout, fill up the inner part of the casing here, because you don't have to worry about the backside, because between the casing and the borehole wall, there's already cement. So you would come up hole, and then once you got to here and the casing is gone, then you just fill the rest of the borehole. That's the best way to plug a well. And let's see. That's an example of the explosive that we use to separate the casing. We lower it down based upon our geophysical logging to where we know the casing collars are. And the first one above the top of the cement, we would shoot it there and then pull out the casing. Okay. This particular hole, we had good cement up here. As you can see, we have separation. It's just pinging out. But down here below, there was no cement. It just rattles between the casing and the borehole wall as it goes out into the formation. So what we would do here is we can't cut the casing out because it's cemented in. But the lower part of the casing, where there's no cement, we could perforate the hole, the casing, open it up so that when we fill the casing from bottom to top, and then from top all the way to the ground surface, we get the best seal possible because the backside is being grouted by the perforated holes, allowing the cement to move out into the casing, into the backside of the borehole, I mean. And those are the perforated shots. As you can see, they're directional. You go use your geophysics, go down to where you need to perforate, and it's all done from the logging truck. So it's the same cable. It sends a different signal. It sends a signal that fires these off. Okay, let's see. We did a nice video on borehole abandonment, and this is the how to get there. I think we also have it linked in the page for the webinar. I wasn't supposed to show you this, but this is my last. I gave this talk 4 years ago. You can also get a downloaded copy of this because it's being recorded, or you can get slides if you like, but it's all linked to your webinar link. And I just say, know your borehole. Take the time to log it. If you're drilling 200 or 300 or 400 foot well, it's really nice to know what you have in it and what's down there. So, Cindy, I think I'm done.
Oh, you're not done yet.
No, I'm done with the presentation.
That sounds accurate. Okay. Good thing. I've got a bunch of questions rolling in for you, Don.
Okay.
First off, let's kind of start towards the material toward the end. Can you talk a little more about packers and packer testing? We had a handful of questions on that. Can you use it in overburden situations? Or let's see, and what kind of distance do you usually use between your packers? And what controls that?
Well, I'll take the second part first. What controls it is the interval that you want to look at. If you've got if you've got one single little fracture there that you think is producing water or could produce water, packer spacing could be very tight. But if you've got a number of fractures that you want to and you want to group them kind of, because you can't do every single one by himself. So it's kind of subjective. you need to look at the log and kind of make a subjective call. You can space the Packers however long you want. So you kind of have to look at the log, see how many whole zones you want to do, then try to select an interval that's consistent so you don't have to keep changing separations between testing. And the first part was talking a little bit about Packers again, Cindy, I'm sorry.
I think that most of what you do Packer testing with involves fractured bedrock. But,
right. That's why the title is of the paper was in bedrock fractured bedrock, in bedrock, because you can't do this in an overburden situation. Because you have if overburden has to be well, I would say most of the time would have to be cased, and once you case the hole, keep it from collapsing, then you can't run logs in it. So these techniques are pretty much for open hole bedrock wells, and except for the gamma log that can help you correlate sands and clays between overburden wells and in an overburden situation.
Okay, that said, would you do that with a screened well at all if you had a particular interval screened, like in overburden?
Well, seeing how I guess the question is if you have a very long screen and you want to isolate zones within it, could you do it? And I would say I would be very leery of doing it because of the sand pack behind the screen would allow all those different zones to bridge together. And I wouldn't do Packer testing in the screen. Now, there are some techniques out there that say, well, you can hang this passive diffusion bag at various lengths in the borehole or even in a screened hole. But if there's any vertical flow in it, you're just going to get the same values unless you understand the vertical flow in the well. You wouldn't be able to discern that really with a heat pulse flow meter. I don't think it would work.
Sounds good. All right. Thanks, Ben. Let me pull another question here. So when you're talking about blasting, and you mentioned focusing on collars, can you blast anywhere along the casing, or
you could, but the collars are usually 20 or 30 foot separation, and you've got several hundred borehole feet that were pad production casing in it and cemented, so you want to get as much of that casing out as you can, but it's okay to leave a few feet still in the borehole, because you're going back down that casing anyway to because you need the cement from the bottom up. So targeting the collars is because that's the easiest place to separate the pipes, because that's where the threads are, and they're weakest there. So that's just kind of practice in the oil fields. That's what we do.
Great, thank you. Now let's go back a little more and talk about just downhole tools in general. So of these tools that you showed us today, are most of them available as one single tool goes down the hole at a time, or are there combos that you can use? Can you touch on that a little bit?
There are combos. Like I know a lot of gamma tools have a temperature with them, but your more sophisticated tools, your heat pulse flow meter, your acoustic and optical televiewer, those are specific separate instruments. Unless somebody's come up with a way to put both acoustic and optical on the same tool, and which I guess is theoretically possible. But it doesn't take that long to run to the bottom of the hole and log up several times. You could do a deep hole with multiple sounds in a day.
Thank you. Now, let's see. Back to where you were measuring deviations on a borehole. Mm-hmm. What kind of tool do you use for that?
It's a borehole deviation tool. It's It has a compass, so it knows its orientation, and it has a way to figure out its inclination, and just gives you your deviation. It's pretty simple, really. But I think that if you're planning on doing any packer testing in a deep rock hole, you might want to see that you don't have a problem. It's not run a lot, but I like running it.
Great. Okay. And now, is there a depth limit for some of these tools?
Well, your depth limit would be how much cable you have. I mean, in the oil fields, they go to tens and 20,000 feet. But we're in hydrogeology, you know, if you're 1,000 feet, that's deep. So if you have a deeper application, you can certainly find a vendor that would be able to hire to do the logging. I'm sure they will have no problem.
Okay. Now, of these tools that you've discussed today, are most of these applicable to using an open borehole, or are some of them, can they be used in monitoring wells, or what? So what kind of
I understand the question.
Characteristics are you looking at? Yeah.
A monitoring well could be an open borehole.
right.
So, yeah, yes, but they're not applicable basically into cased holes. Cased holes meaning PVC or steel casing with a screen. That your gamma could work, should work, but the rest of them need open borehole. I guess your deviation tool would work too in a deeper cased well, but it's not going to give you the deviation of the hole. It's going to give you the deviation of the pipe, but it'd probably be very similar. So I guess you could do that. I just don't know why you'd want to. Because you've already cased the well. You don't need to know if it's deviated.
Right. So maybe a little more obvious for that type of tool than for some of the others.
Yeah.
Okay. So going back to near the beginning of your presentation when you were showing some of the optical viewing tools, you were looking at water cascading down the side of a borehole. Would you sample that water somehow?
That's what we did.
Okay, so how do you target that depth? Would you need to pack it off, or?
Yeah, that's exactly what we did. That's exactly what we did, and that was the whole point of, taking essentially one volume in the upper zone because you know it's groundwater, it's coming right in, and why you would want to sample over time. And multiple, in other words, multiple samples over time in the lower zones that might be accepting water from a cascading system so that you get past the contribution of the cascading water.
Great. Okay.
Into what the true formation water is.
Okay. Do you have some tips or tricks that you would want to share on how you select the location of the borehole on site?
Oh, that's 35 years.
Big question.
it's like when the EPA wants me to write a field manual on how to do something. You know, it's every situation is different, and you just have to look at what you have and make some calls and put some. In that case of Cayuga County, I just found it hard to believe that they were saying that the shallow contamination was going north, and yet we had all these deeper wells in the south that were contaminated. So I picked locations that were close to their plant on the other side of the highway and went down to depths that were equivalent elevations of the wells, residential wells that were contaminated as identified by the DOH. So that was just one. You know, you have to be a hydro. You know, I can't really. You know, every situation is different.
True. Now, Don, I'm not sure about this question, but are you familiar with, or do you use USGS's Flash software for hydraulic conductivity at all?
I'm not familiar with it, no.
Okay. Someone was asking about flow meters, but I don't think we have an answer for them.
Well, there are other types of flow meters besides the heat pulse flow meter, and I neglected to mention. I usually have a sentence I throw in there. They're for higher rated flows, you know, we're not talking a half gallon a minute up or down or a gallon even. We're talking about major flows, 10s and 20s and 30, high volume flows. Then there are some tools that are impeller driven, and it depends how fast the impeller is rotated due to the flow, and that's proportional to, you know, where you can calculate what the flow is. But that's another type of flow meter that you can use in situations where there's really high vertical flow. I don't know if that's the tool that was referenced here.
I'm not clear on it. I'll come back to that person. So let's see. All right, we've got a whole bunch of good questions coming in here. Let me.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, we're not letting you go anywhere for a while here. So let's say you have a much bigger site than you know what to do with. So if you're in fractured bedrock and you've got a low budget, which are your go-to tools that you're going to use first? What are you going to get the most information out of?
It depends on what you're... I mean, there might be some superficial geophysics techniques you might be able to use depending on the geology and what's known about the contamination and where it might be and where there might be confining zones and more permeable zones. Those geophysical surveys are relatively inexpensive. I mean, if you're into fractured bedrock, you're not talking about direct push technology where you can go out with a geoprobe and put 40 holes in a day. You're pretty much going to be limited to conventional bedrock drilling. And as far as you space your wells, you might have to run it in a phased approach where that you put some in and see what you get and then put some others in where you think you could get more data gaps filled. That was kind of the case of the New York job. We went back there several times. We kept working our way back down towards the lake where the contamination was first noticed. Drilling wells is not cheap, and it's just getting more and more expensive, which is why logging those holes, which is the point of my talk, was to be able to glean as much out of the money you spent putting the hole in the ground for a relatively minor cost, even though it is an increase of cost overall. But it can give you a lot of information that can help you if you're doing a phased approach and the next phase maybe you can do something a little differently. Maybe you're not sampling as much. You found that it's only deep, so why not just case off the upper portion and set conventional wells? I mean, it depends on the site and what we have, but... Yeah, you're going to spend money if you're doing an investigation in rock. There's no two ways about it. The key is to get, the key is the limit. For me, the key is to limit how much a taxpayer has to pay.
I'm sure they all appreciate that. So it sounds like what you're recommending overall is kind of an adaptive approach.
Oh, yeah. You have to be adaptive. That's why I like what I do, because every time I go out on a site, it's different. It's exciting and it's fun for me. It keeps it interesting for me. I'm sure the people writing the checks are not that interested.
They don't know that geology life. All right, we have a question from someone from EPA. They mentioned, we commonly see indications of leakage into open borehole wells like the Puerto Rico case study showed. Should we be insisting that cement bond logs are done on all bedrock installations used for site characterization and remediation?
Well, if the leakage is coming into the well from below the casing, then the casing wasn't set deep enough. If the contamination is coming in because the casing was set into a highly fractured zone that you know is permeable, then that was a mistake. I would insist that the casing is cemented in a competent rock, as competent as you could get it. So you want to make sure you get through those upper fractures. I remember hearing something when I was in a school. It was 90% of your fractures are in your top 10 feet or top 100, in your top 10%, something like that. So you're going to have a lot of fracturing up top, but you've got to seal it off. Otherwise, you're going to have either clean water coming in, or you're going to have diluting your samples, or you're having surface contamination coming in. And in that case, in Puerto Rico, it was not only the VOCs, it was also coliform.
Okay.
I think
you covered it.
Yeah.
All right.
But a heat pulse flow meter could tell you if you have vertical flow. And if that vertical flow starts at the top, then you know you've got flow from top down.
Okay. Actually, on that note, someone also asked if you could measure horizontal flow with a downhole tool. Is there such a tool that exists?
Yes, there is. I don't personally have a lot of faith in it. Somebody sent me some information on it once. I just don't think it's that valuable. I mean, you'd have to place it right at the spot where the horizontal flow is occurring. And I don't know how you would know that.
Right.
So you would know it because you know where the water's coming in and if there was vertical flow. I still think the vertical component would probably dwarf the horizontal.
In what you're picking up?
Yeah, if this affects it. So. But there is a tool, and I know it's out there, that people out there selling things all over the place that I wouldn't buy.
Right. Okay. Let me pull some more. Still got a bunch of good questions coming in. We'll take some more for about 5 or so minutes, and then we'll start to wrap this up. Sorry, give me just a moment.
And while you're looking, please, yep. my contact information is up in various places. Feel free to call me if there's follow-up questions or you want to go into something in depth.
Here's a question. How does weathering of upper saturated bedrock zones affect the horizontal groundwater flow relative to fractures and bedding planes?
Well, I'm wondering if this is a ringer asking this question because I'm working on a site right now that's like that. depends on the degree of weathering and what the horizontal permeability or K would be in that situation. Fractures, it depends on how big they are and how many there are. But horizontal flow in a weathered system could almost be equated to unlithified sediment. I mean, it can have that kind of permeability.
Okay. All right. So, Don, when you were showing some gamma log examples earlier, you had I think it was just kind of a generic lithology labeled next to those signals that were coming up. So,
yep.
Did you identify this geology primarily based on the API units, or was there, do you use local or regional geology to pull that up?
If I believe that is the one I said, well, here's the volcanic ash, and it's a bentonite, and it's an instantaneous marker, that's pretty much a cartoon, that drawing.
Okay.
I got it from somewhere because I wanted I wanted something that showed typical gamma responses relative to different types of units, and that was the best one I found. It wasn't from any specific or known borehole or geology. It was just informational.
Okay, thanks. Back to the gamma tool. So these, I think, can be run in a cased hole. Do you run into certain kinds of casing that are problematic for that tool, or?
Well, I would say the denser. I would say the denser the casing, it would dampen the response. But the responses would still be relative to each other. If that makes any sense.
So as long as your casing's the same through the hole, then you.
Yeah, and then again, if you've got a cased hole and you've got a bentonite seal, that's going to affect it because it's going to be telling you you've got a lot of gamma coming through and it might be in the sandstone. So you got to be careful gamma logging, and then even cement casing, because cementing the casing in can affect the gamma responses. So and you don't see it done very much because I don't see it done a lot.
Okay. Now, when you're using the ATV, can you determine strike and dip orientation of fractures with that tool?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Easy one. Okay.
Yeah. Once you know the borehole diameter and the distance from the top of the fracture going through the boring to the base where boric's exiting, if you will, and you know the distance between, and you know where north is, you can do strike and dip.
Exactly. Okay. Sounds good. Now, I don't know if you have experience with this, but I do believe we'll have some more info about it on our next webinar. Don, do you work with NMR at all?
Well, I'll answer your question with a question, and that'll answer your question.
Okay.
Is that a company or is that a technique?
Technique.
Well, okay. There's your answer. I don't know what it is.
Okay. It's
nuclear magnetic resonance.
Nuclear magnetic resonance. Sorry. It was on the tip of my thumb. Okay.
This was introduction to environmental geophysics.
Thanks. We'll answer that participant's question next time with Fred DeLuis of USGS. let me see if I can find some more questions that are good for us today. There are a bunch more coming in. How about, let's see, do you have, oh, no, sorry, give me just a moment. Okay. Do you have a excuse me. Someone asked about software available for boring log presentation. That tends to be one that I think just different people have their different preferences. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with it. There's a number of softwares that you can purchase or I guess even rent. I mean some of the logs I showed you was from the Cayuga County site and that was a cooperative site between EPA and USGS, and USGS has their own software that's proprietary. I believe it still is, and the reason I was able to use it is because I was an author on the paper, but that's really, I think, the best software. But I've hired because ERT doesn't maintain the equipment and the contractor expertise to do the geophysical logging. I find it more cost effective to sub that kind of work out. And if you sub it out, the people that are doing it are going to have the software they need to depict the data.
Sounds good. Thanks. Now, let's see. Do you want to comment some on using cross-hole tomography to map stratigraphy?
No, I haven't really done any of that, and it's not really something we run into. It wouldn't be something I would have shown in a course like this, obviously, because I don't know it. I just don't know what it really measures. I think it is some type of a tool to get stratigraphic information, but that's as far as I know.
We'll put that on the list for our more advanced class.
Okay,
let's see. Now, got a couple more here. Oh, got a lot of comments. Let me see if I can find another question for you. Okay, I think that's about it. Don, do you have any more comments for us today or anything else you want to point our viewers to?
No, I would add to your recommendation about the upcoming courses by Dale and I forget the guy's name from USGS, but they would probably be something that you would want to. They're not I don't know if they're going to talk much or any about borehole work, but they certainly talk about superficial geophysics.
Right. Oh, Don, I have one more question for you. You did mention that ERT video that's included in the links here. Can you tell us what that's about?
It's about how we use borehole geophysics along with, it kind of summarizes those four slides at the end of my presentation showing you how we abandon oil wells. And these were relatively shallow oil wells, but the deeper you go, the more complicated it gets. But I think we were doing it this way for holes that were a couple thousand feet deep.
Okay.
So that it just shows what goes on in the oil fields and what problems you have and how much mud you're in.
Okay, and then there's also so the link I'm referring to for you all online is over in the related URLs on the right side of your screen, so you can go check out the ERT video of Kentucky oil wells there, and then there's also another link. This is a presentation that Don did, the hydrogeologic appraisal.
Well, that was a paper that came out of the Cayuga County site. So it'll go more in depth on what that site was and how we handled it.
Great. Okay. Well, at this point, I want to go ahead and wrap this up and thank our speaker, Don. Thank you so much for joining us today. Let me give you a couple of reminders here. This is one of three in a three-part series. So earlier this week, we had a presentation on environmental geophysics. And we will have one more session the week after next that will be on how to choose your geophysical tools. So right now that presentation from earlier this week on environmental geophysics and how they're applied to site characterization, plume mapping, and remediation monitoring, that archive will be available on Cluent. If you go back to the homepage from today's webinar, there's a link to get over to that one. You can watch that online. Also, you can register for this upcoming webinar with Fred Day-Lewis of the U.S. Geological Survey. He'll be with us Monday, October 29th. Same time, 1 p.m. Eastern. I encourage you guys, if you enjoyed today's presentation, join us for those others, please. You can also get connected with Cluent on social media and sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. This will give you information about new webinars and resources related to hazardous waste site cleanup. I want to thank you again for joining today's live webinar. Slides and other items related to this session can be found on the seminar resources page. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. You'll also find information for our speakers and organizers on the presenters page, as noted earlier. I ask you to take a brief moment to fill out the online feedback form. Let us know what you thought of today's session. We'd like to know what you thought of both the content covered and the method of delivery. Although we don't offer PDHs or CEUs for our webinars, you can save or print a webinar participation certificate after you've submitted feedback for today's event. Make sure that you check the box at the bottom of that form to certify you were here for the entire event or replay the complete archive. Checking that box will ensure that you get that certificate emailed to you. You'll find that this certificate and a copy of the slides may get you the certification from your accrediting institution for PDHs or CEUs. If you participated as a group, each person can fill out that online feedback form to get their own certificate, and that applies both to those watching the live version and those who've seen the recorded version. We do look at your comments as we continue to try and improve the content and delivery mechanisms of our webinars, so I encourage you, please fill out that feedback form. Lastly, this session today was recorded, so in the future you should be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today, and you'll automatically receive an email once that archive is available. That's the end of our final reminders. Thank you for joining on today's session, and I hope you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time.